Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary in for Larry Mantle this week. Later on this hour, Russia says it will pull out of the International Space Station after 2024. If Russia follows through, and there's some skepticism about whether they actually will, some are concerned it would be extremely difficult to operate the space station effectively without the Russian Roscosmos, the Russian space program. We'll look at the future of the orbiting outpost if Russia does pull out and explore what the move signals for the future of collaborative space exploration between Russia and the Western world. Now, at 11, you'll hear 1A instead of Air Talk's second hour. We're giving our hardworking production staff a bit of a rest while Larry is gone. Today at 11, the Food and Drug Administration's trying to do something about teenagers who vape every day, what restrictions should be placed on e-cigarettes and vaping products, and what's the government's role in regulating them in the first place. That's 1A today at 11. But first, there have been a lot of theories over the last 2 years about the origin of the SARS-CoV-2. That's the virus that causes COVID-19. Now, we may actually have some clarity on exactly where the virus was first transmitted to humans and how. A new report from a UCLA-led team of researchers confirms that live animals sold at the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market in Wuhan, China, are likely the source of the COVID-19 pandemic. The findings appeared Tuesday in two peer-reviewed papers in the journal Science, and they not only identify the place of origin, but also conclude that the virus was introduced to multiple vendors through the live animals they were selling, and that these vendors likely spread it to the surrounding communities in two separate transmission events in late November 2019. With me right now is Joshua Levy, postdoctoral researcher at the Scripps Research Institute and the second author of this first study we're talking about this morning, which looked at the seafood market in Wuhan, China as an early epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, thank you, Joshua, for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for your research. Let's start with the basics. What was the study looking at? What was it looking for?
Sure. So this is a huge collaborative effort, bringing in all different types of data, trying to understand where all of these cases were in the early goings of this expanding epidemic, which later became this pandemic. So we pulled data from the WHO's report, looking at cases that were identified based on different signs and symptoms, hospitalizations in the early going in December of 2019. This all sort of points to a single epicenter that is centered and has a maximum case density right at this Huanan seafood market in this western part of Wuhan.
Now, is this seafood market something that you can visualize? Have you ever seen it? Can you describe what kind of critters were there?
Sure. So you might notice that it is called the Huanan Seafood Market, but it is much more than that. If you actually dig into photo, video evidence of the market, which I've never been to myself, but have seen quite a lot of footage of, you can see that there is a large segment on the western portion of the market that largely takes part in live wildlife trade, not seafood related really whatsoever. There's things that are being sold there, like raccoon dogs, various types of hares, different types of deer, hedgehogs, you name it. They're all kind of in this western side of the market, stacked on top of each other in not the most sanitary of conditions.
And they're being sold for pets or for food?
That is more of a complicated question, but yeah, I think a bit of both is probably the case, but it's unclear. I think there is some of both going on there.
So let's drill down into the certainty of the findings, because in the press release announcing these findings, it says the team has confirmed that live animals sold at this market were the likely source of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we know few things in this world are absolute, and there may be no way to say with 100% accuracy that this market was the origin. But in light of your research, how sure can we be?
Yeah, I think at this point, this is pretty clear proof that, beyond any reasonable doubt, that this is actually what happened. If you actually start digging into the market, so, continuing to zoom in a little bit, not only was, this early epicenter at the market, but if you start looking in at the individual sampling of the market, so after the market was shut down at the end of December of 2019, WHO and Chinese CDC teams went in and actually did environmental sampling of the market, swabbing anything from doors, walls, cages that were containing these wild animals, different instruments for actually removing fur and feathers, and tested them for SARS-CoV-2. And if you actually look at where all of these positive samples were collected, they're strongly biased to this southwestern component of the market where all of these live wildlife trade was going on. In particular, you can see there's a handful of stalls that comprise a ton of these samples. In fact, there's one stall that has 5 positive environmental samples, and they're swabbed from things like cages that were used to actually contain these animals, or instruments for removing fur and feathers and things like that. So this is strongly pointing not only to this area of the market is a clear hot spot of virus and live wildlife trade. But it's also the case that a lot of these early cases happen on the western side of the market. So if you actually look at the cases that happened before December 20th, they're all on the western side of the market in fairly close proximity to where this live wildlife trade is going on.
And then the study described using a technique called molecular clock analysis to kind of describe how the virus developed or evolved. Can you explain what this is and how it helped you arrive at the conclusion that the virus had to be transmitted through, from animals jumping to humans in multiple instances rather than just one single jump?
Yeah, so that's honestly, it's a better question for Jonathan, who will be coming on shortly.
Okay.
To say briefly, basically, it's a way of looking at the evolution of the actual genome of the virus over time. And we can use that to get a sense of, whether or not it could have just been one super spreader event that might have just been amplified at the market versus, a multiple different jumps from animals to humans. But I should let Jonathan talk a little bit more on that. He is the true expert on that topic.
I do think we have Jonathan on. Let's go quickly to Jonathan Picar, graduate student in the Department of Biomedical Informatics at the University of California, San Diego, co-author of the first study, lead author on a second study that we'll hear about. Jonathan, tell me a little bit about this molecular clock process that you guys used.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here. So the molecular clock process, basically, we know that viruses as well as other things evolve at a given rate. And then knowing that, we can make certain inferences about how long they've been evolving and what the evolution might have looked like in the Huanan market and in Wuhan generally. And so we did some molecular clock inference, meaning we tried to reconstruct the evolutionary history of SARS-CoV-2 using viruses or genomes sampled from the cases around Wuhan. And with that, we basically saw that, especially coupled with simulations, I should add, coupled with some modeling, we saw that there were likely 2 jumps that happened rather than 1, or at least 2 jumps of the virus from animals into humans because it was more concordant with the observed patterns and data of spread and evolution. That two jumps basically just made a lot more sense with the evolution of SARS-CoV-2 early on in the pandemic.
And so you're kind of like tracing the family tree of this virus. And so it's fair to say there's no one patient zero for COVID-19, but multiple ones. Can you talk a little bit about how it got out of the market into the surrounding community?
Sure. So that might actually be a slightly better question for Josh.
Okay. Well, let's go back then to Joshua Levy. Tell me about how it got into the community from the market.
Yeah. So basically the clear kind of signs point to the fact that initially you're getting an initial transfer of the virus from an intermediate species. Could be a raccoon dog, could be a deer. We don't actually know what that species is. But then it gets into a vendor or, you know, maybe someone who's visiting one of these shops, and they begin to spread it not only throughout the market, but, you know, however they chose to get to the market. Maybe they ride on a public bus and they spread it that way, or, you know, they go visit a family member. Or, for example, we know that there's early reports of games of Mahjong being played in the corner of a market, of this market specifically, where, you know, poor ventilation would have easily been a place for some spreading to happen. So there's lots of, once you have the first few cases starting to happen, there's plenty of opportunities, as we've seen later in the pandemic, for spreading to happen, not only within, you know, individual stalls, but throughout the larger community. One thing that's clear, though, is that there's this kind of initial seeding that happens at the market, and then sort of this ripple effect going outwards, where basically initially things are, you know, highest case density around the market or and in the market, and then slowly it sort of bleeds out, diffuses out throughout the city of Wuhan and then later to the rest of the world.
Well, when the team of international researchers was first considering doing this study, was there an alternate theory that seemed any more certain than this market, you know, jumping from animal to human theory?
I mean, we were very much willing to consider any sort of possible theory of you know, the original evolution of this virus and original jump into humans. But upon looking at the evidence pretty clearly, there's only one sort of direction where all of the data points, and it's pretty strongly in favor of this small region of Wuhan, specifically centered at this Wan'an market, where there's really only kind of one clear interpretation of this data. And we haven't seen any data that really points in any other direction. Certainly, you know, we can come up with all sorts of different sorts of theories, but following the data, this is where it takes us, and it's, I think, a pretty convincing case now that this is where it happened, and the live wildlife trade is where it really originated.
Question for Joshua Levy, postdoctoral researcher at Scripps Research Institute. Okay, so we've got the study. It's done. What good comes from this study in heading off potential future pandemics?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one key thing that we actually get out of this sort of research is kind of opening the door to figuring out what are the areas of risk or the steps in different markets or different practices that are particularly risky in terms of generating possible pandemic viruses. So it could be anything from, you know, maybe storage of animals in cages from the wild on top of one another is not something that we should be doing, and we should be reining back on that. And this is something that is not supposed to be legal, and, you know, is something that is supposed to be, you know, reined in on very soon, and should already have been reined in on. Of course, there's other things that are major risk factors that we don't discuss in the paper, but, you know, will be the subject of future research. seems like, you know, how does the fact that we're continually encroaching on wild animal habitats affect, you know, the frequency of these sorts of events? So we don't really know what happened upstream of the market. So there's still a lot of question marks there saying, you know, why is it that we are seeing, you know, these reservoir species starting to get pandemic level viruses, coronaviruses from this area, and you know, becoming in sufficiently close contact with not only bats and humans that we can start to get this happening more often, unfortunately.
So there's some really good policy implications that could be enacted in some others. Now, if this is for either Jonathan or Joshua, if you consider it important for the public to understand that this is indeed the cause of the virus, what plans exist to convey that message to the public in a non-technical way? I mean, obviously one that's broader than just being on Air Talk.
Sounds
good. So one is, I mean, I think we have to have a more general discussion about what, you know, wildlife trade and also not, you know, our farmed wildlife is potentially capable of introducing into our population. And this is something that, you know, certainly is happening throughout the world. It's not just something that happened in Wuhan. We also have, you know, large amounts of wildlife trade here. And there are enormous risk factors associated with that. So it's all about kind of, you know, trying to make sure we're interacting with wildlife in a safe and, you know, virus-aware manner. But Jonathan, you should go for it.
Sure. Yeah, I'm in full agreement with Joshua. With these animal trades, it's important to understand what conditions will lead to potential outbreaks, and that once those conditions are right, like in as it was in the Huanan market, the Huanan seafood wholesale market, you can expect multiple viruses to start spilling over if there is such a virus present in that population. And so there could be a lot of risk associated with the animal trade there, and we need to be extremely mindful of it. And with that in mind, it's also important to have a system set up where we can quickly detect disease.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much. I want to thank both of our guests, scientists who've done some important research into the COVID-19 pandemic, Jonathan Picar, graduate student in the Department of Biomedical Informatics at the University of California, San Diego, who co-authored one of these studies, lead author on the second study, and Joshua Levy, postdoctoral researcher at Scripps Research Institute. Thank you both for your very hard work. We'll be back after this short break.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome back to Air Talk. I'm Sharon McNary in for Larry Mantle this week. The migratory monarch butterfly is a common sight here in Southern California, the subspecies of monarchs. They migrate to California and as far as Canada to breed and head to Mexico to hibernate. A few years ago, our studio in Pasadena was just inundated with the monarch butterflies as they were passing through. I know it's just a coincidence that our walls are painted orange and black, just like those butterflies. But recently, fewer of them have been able to make the trip. Migratory monarch butterflies are now considered endangered, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, a nonprofit focused on nature conservation. Man-made climate change, deforestation and pesticides are some of the significant reasons for the decline of migratory monarchs by 22 to 72% over the past decade. So you would have seen a lot of them. Now there's just fewer passing through the region, stopping here to breed, moving on. We're going to try and get a better understanding of how this endangered listing came to be and the conservation efforts to save these monarchs with Monica Bohm. She is co-chair of the International Union for Conservation of Nature's SSC Butterfly and Moth Specialist Group. Monica, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, thank you so much. And to our listeners, we want to hear your thoughts on preserving the monarch butterflies. What are you doing to help keep them going? Give us a call at 866-893-5722 or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. Tell us where you're writing from. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. So, Monica, can you take our listeners through the process of how your organization, IUCN, labels an animal or insect or other critter as endangered?
Yes, so the IUCN is probably most famous for its red list of threatened species. This is kind of what most people generally come across as the main product of the IUCN. Now, the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species really does give and feeds off a lot of experts who give their expertise and their data and so on to make assessments of the extinction risk of pretty much any species that you can think of. And that extinction risk could be very low. So sometimes species get classified as least concern. And then it goes all the way up to the threatened categories, which we kind of call vulnerable, endangered, critically endangered, and then the categories that you get next is things like extinct in the wild or extinct. And so the monarch butterfly really was kind of long overdue to take a space on this IUCN red list so that we can kind of keep tabs on how it's doing in this framework of looking at extinction risk. And so over the last year or so, colleagues of mine and I looked at the data that had been gathered for decades now to classify the species for this IUCN red list. And really that red list looks at various things that relate to extinction risk. Things like if you see populations dropping dramatically, for example, over a time period that really means something for that species. Or if you see a species habitat shrink or area where it occurs shrink, or if you have really tiny population sizes, for example. These kind of things give us an idea that a species might be at a higher extinction risk. And so based on data that have been collated by tons and tons of people out in the field, we kind of looked at what happened to the monarch or the migratory monarch specifically in this case, which is like a subspecies of the monarch butterfly. What happened over the last 10 years and what we've seen is really that the decline rates are high enough to warrant an endangered listing on the IUCN red list.
So now, does that mean the colony or the species is like close to collapsing, like there's not enough critical mass for them to survive as a species?
This essentially means that we've seen around 50% decline in the populations over the past 10 years. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty around some of these estimates simply because it's very difficult to keep tabs on like an invertebrate. We're not that good at counting precise numbers of invertebrates over time. But from all the data that we looked at, that's kind of what we think is the case for this species. Now, what that means is that, in the past we had, if you think back to like the 80s or so, you had like millions of this species. And now towards the later years, in 2021, for example, for the Western population of the migratory monarch, we've only seen around 2,000 individuals or something like this.
Wow. Now, there's been a lot of press following the announcement, which I'd imagine is because of what the monarch means to folks here in California and in North America. How much of that kind of affection we have for the monarch, how much is that helping with conservation efforts?
I think it's helping a great deal. So I'm a very recent addition to North America. So I'm actually currently living through my first monarch migratory season, so to speak, or monarch season, having only recently moved here. The immense affection and the kind of limelight that I've seen already for this species in the media, in the news, and so on, is absolutely astonishing. And just looking at what happens locally to where I'm based in Indiana, for example, there are now several Monarch events coming up in the next few months, looking at this species. And so I assume that's obviously going to be even bigger in places like California, for example, where some of the overwintering populations, for example, are as well. And that means that a lot of people have been activated to kind of do positive stuff for the species. And we all can, right? Monarchs rely on specific plants for their larvae, milkweed, for example. And if we plant milkweed in our gardens, in other areas, in our towns and cities that we can turn into monarch habitat, then that helps the species as well.
Well, so to give listeners an understanding of the scope of this decline, how much of the monarch population is made up of these migratory monarchs that are now endangered?
So that's a good question. I actually don't really entirely know the precise number. So the migratory monarch is a subspecies of the wider species. That's the monarch butterfly. And the monarch butterfly has, as a species, even spread to some places outside of North America, for example. So it's a pretty large, widespread population that we see, and it's generally not declining that fast. What we see with a migratory monarch really is that here we've seen these very specific declines in population that let us make this assessment of a higher extinction risk.
So also with us to talk about the monarch butterflies that are now endangered is Scott Black. He's the executive director of the Xerces, which is a nonprofit that's focused on invertebrate conservation. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sharon.
What is Xerces doing to help with the conservation of migratory monarch butterflies here in the Western United States?
Yes, well, we're doing a lot, but we need to do more. I do want to just preface this by saying we are seeing major declines in this animal. We're seeing them across its North American range, both in the east and in the west, but we're seeing them worse in the west. So the IUCN looks at things in 10-year chunks. The Xerces Society has analyzed data from overwintering sites all the way back into the 80s, and in California, we've lost at least 95% of the monarchs that used to overwinter along the California coast. So it's a major issue, and we need all hands on deck.
Well, speaking of which, what can regular people do to assist with conservation efforts for migratory monarchs? We get a lot of questions about milkweed. Denise in Crenshaw Manor is saying, are all species of milkweed helpful for the butterflies, or are there only specific kinds that help?
Yeah, there are only specific kinds that help. But what I will say is that anybody can help. Xerces works with land managers, with farmers, with gardeners, with everyone else to do conservation. And what monarchs need are milkweed, and they need native milkweed. So native milkweed grew here in California before we got here, and that's monarch's favored host plant. So go to your nursery, ask them, what is the local native milkweed if I live in LA? There are two or three species to get. But they also need lots of flowering plants. Monarchs, as you might imagine, being migratory, they travel a long way, and so they need a lot of fuel. So the adults feed on a whole variety of mostly native, but not exclusively native, flowers, and they sip the nectar to have the energy to fly these long distances, and then they find milkweed, and they lay their eggs on it, and the caterpillars eat the milkweed, and that's their kind of nursery. And then the other really important thing is pesticides. So most insecticides especially kill insects, and that means they kill monarchs, they kill bees, they kill other butterflies. And if you have a yard or garden, you just don't need to use pesticides. You know, you can pull weeds by hand. You can live with a little bit of imperfection, and your bees, butterflies, and monarch butterflies will thank you for that. So those are really the main main things, milkweed, lots of flowers, and then just get off the pesticide habit.
Well, I mean, I am relieved that there's an alternative to milkweed. I've heard it's pretty tall, and the forest says it spreads quickly and can be difficult to remove. And it not only feeds butterflies, but also a number of other insects that I might not want, like flies, beetles, and wasps. So I'm happy to plant flowers. But Xerces also released a call to action for monarchs here in the state, and you're calling for different actions in different parts of the state. You call them priority action zones. For example, in our listener area, you say not to plant milkweed within 1 mile of the coastline. Why is that?
Well, that is because milkweed never grew within 1 mile of the coastline. And there's a new species of milkweed that some people are planting called tropical milkweed. It's called Curasavica, actually, but that's the scientific name, but it's tropical milkweed. And it's green all year. And what it seems to do is take the monarchs away from their overwintering sites, and they will lay eggs very late in the season. And then those eggs will not be able to successfully turn into caterpillars and turn into butterflies because it's too cold in the winter along the coast there. So these plants also build up with diseases that infect the monarch because they're evergreen. So really, really important to plant the natives.
Okay.
And I do want to address your comment about the other insects. The other insects that visit milkweed are incredibly benign and helpful. You know, if you want, like songbirds, you should be having nurseries for insects, for the flies and the beetles. These are not flies like house flies that are getting in your house. They're not beetles that are going to infest something. These are the native insects that feed our birds, that feed our other animals. And milkweeds are one of the best plants.
Oh, thank you. Now, I'm getting a question from Andy in Hawthorne. Andy wants to know, is the monarch a more important keystone pollinator in Southern California, more important than any other native insects that we know that are also facing significant population declines in the region?
Well, monarchs are important because, as Moni said earlier, people love them. So monarchs are likely not a really important pollinator. They don't pollinate our crops like bees do. We have hundreds, thousands, actually, of native bees in North America that pollinate our crops. We have other butterflies that pollinate certain plants. Monarchs aren't major pollinators. They pollinate a little bit. But they're keystones or umbrella species because we can get people to take action for monarchs. And if you plant flowers and you put in milkweed and you stop using pesticides, you're going to help all the other bees that are out in your landscape. You're going to help the other butterflies. You're going to help yourself because you're going to have a much healthier landscape. So they're an umbrella species that it helps us to get people to take action.
Well, so helping the prettiest of the insects helps a lot of the really useful ones. My thanks go out to Scott Black, Executive Director of Xerces, the nonprofit focused on invertebrate conservation, and also Monica Baum, co-chair of the International Union for Conservation of Nature's SSC Butterfly and Moth Specialist Group, which recently declared the monarch butterfly an endangered species. Thank you both.
Thank you.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
Welcome back to Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary. I'm keeping Larry Mantle's seat warm while he's out on vacation this week. I'm happy to be with you and always happy to talk about space-related topics. Now, I remember getting up out of bed early in the morning when I was a little kid in elementary school and turning on this little tiny black and white TV we had in the living room to watch the early Apollo rockets blast off into space. And back then in the 1960s, this was a matter of national pride and in a sense that we had to rush forward into space to stay ahead of the Russians during the Cold War. You know, we had to get the upper hand. And in a way, kids of that era, like me, benefited from the space race because of the laser focus it put on achieving in engineering and math and science. Now, over the years, as the Cold War eased, nuclear treaties were reached, and our nation's space folk actually collaborated with the Russians and others to build and operate the International Space Station. But now, with Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, that cooperation is in peril. The new head of Russia's space agency says they will end participation in the space station and build their own after the year 2024. And while that raises a number of questions about the future of space cooperation, there are questions about whether this claim is even true. Joining me now to discuss the latest is Kenneth Chang, science reporter for the New York Times, who's been following this story. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for being on Air Talk. So let's start with this ambiguous nature of Russia's announcement. It says after, not by or before, the year 2024. Are folks skeptical about whether this is a legitimate move from Russia?
So Russia has been making repeated comments that it is looking to end this participation in the space station. And it's always been somewhat ambiguous. The last announcement was that they were submitting a proposal, and they were never clear on when they would be leaving. And this one doesn't really clarify. At least they were more direct in saying they were leaving. But again, after 2024 could be any time 2025. It could be even 2030 when NASA wants to end the space station anyway.
Okay. Well, so what is Russia actually saying they plan to do? And are its leaders giving a reason why?
So, of course, there's been a lot of tension between the United States and Russia after the Ukraine invasion. And Russia has been saying that because of the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed is affecting their space program, and they want this sort of saying, if you don't lift the sanctions, we won't continue participating in the space station. And so there's sort of this been back and forth, at least at the high levels, at the operational level. So NASA talking to the Russian, you know, flight directors, that has been going on, it appears, pretty much as normal. So it's sort of this tug of war between the rhetoric at the top levels and the day-to-day operations, which seem to be going on pretty much normally.
Well, and practically, what could Russia do if they actually did leave the International Space Station? What capacity do they still have to get to and operate in space without it?
So at this point, they have the Soyuz rocket, so they can get to and from orbit. Without the International Space Station, they currently wouldn't have any place to go. So the International Space Station is basically their big part of the space program that they have right now. So if they end that, they can build their own new space station, but they really don't have very much money for their space program right now. Or perhaps they could partner with the Chinese, who are building their own space station. Russia is very proud over their long history in space. And to go to the Chinese space station, they would be clearly the junior partner. And that would be, I imagine, embarrassing for them as well.
Yeah, they don't like to be junior to anything, I don't think. The space station is 24 years old, and it's not like it's an old hoopty car where the ashtrays are full and we're going to turn it in for a new one already. What is the space station good for these days, and what are we counting on it to do in the coming years?
So for NASA, there's a couple of things that's really important. One is that they're doing these long-term experiments about the health of astronauts. So if you're in weightlessness and in space for 6 months or longer, things happen to your body, and they want to understand what exactly is going on and how can they mitigate those changes. So, and this is important if they want to go to Mars, because it's a 9-month journey to Mars. And if the astronauts were unhealthy by the time they were about to land, that wouldn't be a good thing. So in weightlessness, a lot of things happen to your body. The calcium gets drained from your bones. Your muscles get weaker, at least at least in the lower body, and even your eyesight changes. And that's something that they've been working on to understand quite a bit for the last few years.
So some of the things that we see coming from the space station, like I think I remember an astronaut ran the New York Marathon on a treadmill in space. Those kinds of things are helpful in moving us forward as we advance farther into space?
Yeah, so for the bone loss, they've largely have a handle on that. So if they do, I believe, like an hour or two of exercise, maybe even more every day, where like in running, you have an impact on your legs, that helps reduce the loss of calcium from the bones. So there's things like that NASA wants to do with the space station. And there's other things. There's various research, experiments taking advantage of the fact that there's almost no gravity there. There's new manufacturing that's going up there. It's also sort of kickstarting a new economy. So SpaceX, basically their entire business started because NASA gave Elon Musk a contract first to take cargo to the space station and now astronauts. And SpaceX is a great success story of a government investment paying off way beyond what NASA needs.
Well, I'm talking with Kenneth Cheng. He's been reporting on Russia's claims that it will pull out of the International Space Station. Listeners, if you have comments about this, questions, give us a call, 866-893-5722, or email us at atcomments@kpcc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation with Kenneth Cheng of the New York Times. We'll also talk with the curator of the International Space Programs and Space Suits at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum. And she also happens to be a historian on Russian and Soviet space programs. That's coming up right after the break. It's On Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Sharon McNary, sitting in for Larry Mantle this week. Right now we're discussing Russia's announcement that it plans to pull out of the International Space Station after the year 2024. Joining me now to discuss the implications of this is Kathleen Lewis. She's curator of the International Space Programs and Space Suits at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. She's also a historian of public culture and Soviet and Russian programs. Thank you for being on Air Talk, Kathleen.
Good afternoon from the East Coast.
From the East Coast. And spacesuits. Why spacesuits?
Spacesuits, by happenstance. I happen to be curator of international space programs. And when our previous spacesuit curator retired, I inherited her collection. That's a very short version of a very long story.
You don't sneak in and try them on?
No, I do not.
Okay. Because I would.
I don't think I would fit, and these are precious objects, and I'm in charge of protecting them from people who would like to try them on.
Okay, well, I promise to stay away then. So we were discussing with the New York Times' Kenneth Cheng a lot of questions about how legitimate this announcement is. What is your take?
We really don't know how legitimate it is. This is a repetition of threats and cautions that the Russians have made for years. It took them a while to agree to the extension to 2024. And, of course, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, there has been a lot of acrimonious threats about retaliation for Western sanctions against Russia. The previous head of Roscosmos, Rogozhin, had threatened and had a rather stressful exchange with one of our astronauts via Twitter. This seems to be a repetition, but not quite as acrimonious statement. So we really aren't going to know what this means until the Russians formally withdraw. They have a year. They have to give a year's advance notice and detail what that actually means. So we're waiting to find out what they really mean by this. Is this just a threat? Is this political grandstanding. There's an understanding in the space program. The politicians can say whatever they want. They have the liberty to do so. But it's the engineers and scientists who have to make things work. And whatever they decide, they're going to have to make it something doable in clarity. And it throws it back to NASA to determine what they can do, how they can maintain operations for another 6 years on the ISS with the other member partners, the remaining partners, and how they can shift the resources that are available or increase the resources at the disposal of the space station.
We do get a question from Robin Mid-Wilshire to that effect. He wants to know why NASA wants to shut down the space station by 2030. Is that something that you know anything about?
That is just the reality of any hardware. Think about it as a car. I used to be one of those people who kept cars forever until it, you know, was dissolved into a grease spot on the driveway.
Me too.
But you have there have been components changed out over the years that makes it for an upgrade, but in terms of long-term, when you're thinking about the vibrations of orbiting in low Earth orbit, the impact of micrometeors while in orbit, there is just too much wear and tear. And you get to a point where the technology gets aged and it can't be swapped out.
Okay, well, that answers the question we got from Gillen Encino about whether it's possible to start doing a full refurbishment of the space station with modern technology. Would it be easier to refurbish it if Russia did leave?
Well, they would continue to refurbish it to keep it safe and productive for the duration and through the 2030 deadline, but they're not going to look for it to keep it alive forever.
Well, let's look back to history. I mean, why was it so important for the Russians to be in collaboration with the U.S. in the creation and operation of the space station? I mean, I imagine it would give us a look over their shoulders at what they were doing, and they could, you know, look over our shoulders and create kind of a mutual trust.
Well, there's mutual trust, and there's also the financial consequences. The Russians really reaped a great windfall of a benefit financially from the retirement of the shuttle program for that almost a decade between that and the first launch, crewed launch of the Dragon capsule to the International Space Station. They were the only way to get to the space station, and so the partners were paying Russia for that transport, for the extra training and everything involved in taking astronauts, cosmonauts, and all the other space travelers to the space station. The Americans also subsidized some of the larger components, the Zvezda component of the space station. And it also, human spaceflight is incredibly expensive. When you think about what you have to do, you have to create a habitat outside of the Earth's atmosphere that gives them air, clean air, water, food, a quiet working place. The space capsules are notoriously noisy, so they have to do extra things to decrease the noise of machinery going on.
I have zero appetite for going to space myself. Listeners, if you have questions about Russia potentially leaving behind the space station, give us a call, 866-893-5722. You can email us at atcomments@kpcc.org and tell us where you're writing from. To Kenneth, Kenneth Chang of the New York Times, if Russia pulls out of the space station, what opportunity does that create for other nations to have a bigger role up there?
If Russia pulls out, it's not clear what would happen yet, because the Russian segment is almost basically half of the space station. So Russia would have to either agree to turn it over to NASA, or somehow it had to be detached, and then NASA would have to reconfigure its half to operate it by itself. And both of those are very difficult to do. You can imagine perhaps that Russia would be willing to sell its half of the space station, and that would be a way to get a financial windfall that it could invest into a space program. But until we get any further details about how what Russia really intends to do and when, everything is basically speculation.
Well, and this question is for Kathleen and then possibly Kenneth as well. In what ways did the creation of the Trump-era Space Force push the Russians to want out of the International Space Station? I mean, to me, Space Force feels more of a militaristic endeavor, unlike the very, you know, nerdy, science-y NASA and JPL scientists that we know and love.
Well, of course, I don't have privy to the conversations going inside the Kremlin, but I, from my perspective as an historian, the creation of the Space Force wasn't really a change. It was a renaming and reorganization of programs and operations that were already in existence.
Hmm.
It was just drawing it out into a separate force. And much of what the Air Force had done and Department of Defense intelligence agencies had done. So it should not have been, it was not a threat. It was just an administrative reorganization of existing operations.
Oh, interesting. A rebranding. What about you, Kenneth? Do you see any impact of Space Force on this move by Russia?
I think that was mostly separate. I mean, the cooperation between NASA and the Soviet Union and now Russia has been very idealistic. It dated back to 1975 when the Apollo-Soyuz mission, where an Apollo spacecraft docked with a Soviet spacecraft in orbit. And if you think about it, that was still in the middle of the Cold War, where there was tanks all across Europe, and we felt like we could have a nuclear war in any moment. So there's always been this idealism that, you know, whatever disagreements we have on Earth, that at least there's a hope for a better future in space where everyone could work together. And that's sort of both sides have liked that idealism. And that's why it's persisted so long.
Right. And it does feel a bit like we're heading back to some kind of a Cold War. But, I mean, here in the post-moonwalk, post-space shuttle era in the U.S., we don't build our own rockets anymore. We have billionaires doing that as federal contractors and as for-profit entrepreneurs. We've got Elon Musk with SpaceX, Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin, Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic. What does the privatization of going into space mean for the future of things like the International Space Station?
Well, actually, NASA's not gotten out of business. It is making the biggest rockets to date so far, the Space Launch System, which is supposed to have its first launch sometime perhaps by end of August. So that part of NASA is still exists. The idea with the privatization is that with other people doing these things that aren't necessarily at the cutting edge anymore, that NASA can get a cheaper service because it's much cheaper with an airlines flying people back and forth instead of if the government was doing that. And hopefully that means NASA has more money to do exploration of the moon.
Very cool. Other things. I want to thank both of my guests. That's Kenneth Chang, science reporter for The New York Times, and Kathleen Lewis, curator of international space programs and space suits at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum. Thank you both for being on Air Talk. That does it for us on Air Talk today. I'm Sharon McNary. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning starting at 10.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.